just how the Department of Law goes about getting $630 million in settlements. So without any further ado, Jim, if you would...
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry, we haven't had a roll call yet. I apologize. You have to leave too.
I was here for quorum purposes. I was going to shuffle back and forth.
I think we're going to.
They need me for quorum. The other one too. So,
would the clerk please please read the roll call and then we'll scatter.
Representative Green.
Here.
Representative Cott.
Here.
Representative Olberg.
Here.
Representative Davis.
Here.
Representative Sanders. Representative
Sitton
and Representative
Knight. We do have a quorum, and so we will ask that Mr. Baldwin now come forward and give us an overview. And I would ask you to identify yourself and be sure the mic's on for the people at the LIO office.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's actually my pleasure to defer on the general overview to the Attorney General, who is in town, just returned from Seattle. And he has asked that he be allowed to address the committee and give you the overview, if he could.
Excellent. For the interest of the people of the LIO, we have Attorney General Cole with us. A pleasant surprise, and so we'll turn the mic over to you, Charlie.
I would like, if the committee please, to give a general overview and let Mr. Baldwin do a little more. Furnish a little more detail, but what I would like to say is, speaking broadly, when Governor Hickel first came here, as I think I've said before, for some reason or other, which really hasn't made any difference to me, the relationship between the Department of Revenue and the Department of Law was not what the governor wanted it to be. And apparently that relationship had gone on for a number of years. There's extensive documentation of lack of cooperation which went on between the Department of Law and the Department of Revenue. So, after a while, Commissioner Rex Winkle and I addressed that situation, and we were able to reach a memorandum of understanding, which was put in writing. I think it's wholly unnecessary to put it in writing. I don't think we've ever looked at it since there's two cryptic pages expressing agreement between us as to how these cases should be addressed. But suffice it to say that after an initial period during which I was accused of wanting to take over the Department of Revenue and things of that nature, frankly, I can't even run well the Department of Law, so I'm certainly not interested in running the Department of Revenue as well. But at any rate, those things have been ironed out. And it's really been gratifying for me to see how this process has come about. And I think of all the things that the Hickel administration has done, at least things that I'm aware of, I think this is a sort of a major accomplishment, because it's enabled us to work cooperatively with the Department of Revenue to address these cases. And how has it worked? Well, the Department of Revenue brings a lot to the process. They audit these returns, audits which have been going on for a considerable period of time. And some of the assessments have been made in the face of statute of limitations, which did not therefore have the benefit of a finely tuned analysis of the assessment. Others have been made, lacking a lot of the type of information which the Department of Law was able to develop in the Royley litigation. In the Royley litigation, which went on for a number of years, largely resolved now, the Department of Law traced virtually every barrel of oil which came out of the North Slope, where it went, and exchanges, shipments to the Gulf Coast, shipments to wherever. And so we developed a great mass of information about the oil transactions which arose out of the North Slope production. So we've been able to furnish that information to the Department of Revenue, and they did not have the resources to do that. You know, it cost some $50 million to accumulate that type of data, but we have that data now. And of course, it was responsible for settlements in excess of $600 million accumulation, putting together that data. So, when these audit assessments are made, the taxpayer gets a bill, of course, asks for, you might say, an informal conference that's provided for in the statutory proceedings. But that really triggers a greater working relationship between the Department of Law and the Department of Revenue. And the lawyers then enter into this process more recently when these cases become referred to the Department of Law. We have retained outside experts of national standing. Jerome Hellerstein, who wrote the definitive work, State Taxation, a two-volume work. A really great figure in the law of taxation. Represented Mobil Oil in cases involving this similar issue before the United States Supreme Court. And other lawyers who have national standing. We did that in this recent case. We sought recommendations, lawyers for the finest lawyers on these issues in the United States. And they gave us, not unexpectedly, different views of some of these major issues. Some said, say, well, my evaluation is so-and-so, and others say my evaluation is so-and-so. Well, I selected Mr. Hellerstein, so I thought that his analysis was sound and well put. So anyway, we then work with, we assemble a settlement team composed of members of the Department of Revenue, senior audit type staff, and representatives of the Department of Law, often outside counsel who have special abilities in these areas. And we, I think, put the microscope on our case. I mean, what I put the microscope on, really look at it very, very carefully, and work together. We then discuss these cases with the taxpayer. We have what I view as a sort of a standard procedure that before we enter into these negotiations, we arrive at what we think is the figure that is our number. That number is arrived at by not simply consensus, but unanimity and everyone on the settlement team does not agree to what I call that number or that analysis or that approach, I mean, then we go back and work the problem again. So that everybody agrees, because we do not want to be in a position that once, if we're able to conclude one of these negotiating sessions, that we hear from somebody across the way or here or there that's saying, you know, they sold out. That's obviously an easy charge always to make. So everybody has to be on the team. We don't get it in blood and we don't get it in writing, but it's not much short of that. Everybody agrees. And I think that's very important, that this process is total unanimity. And then, you know, the negotiating process goes on. We concluded the last transaction, BP. I personally was at 3 sessions. The one before this one lasted about 10 minutes, you know. And, you know. But, you know, I mean, sometimes you just get there and sometimes you don't. But I would like to say this. I think this is important, and I want you to give you this overview because I think it's important that you get the flavor of how these things go, you know. because we are not taking a sledgehammer to these taxpayers. If you know what I mean by that sense, I mean we are proceeding professionally, courteously, and I'd say in good faith. That describes the concept. And often they are the ones who come to us and say, are you ready to in a position to sit down and talk about this assessment with us? And sometimes we say, no, we're not quite ready. As a matter of fact, in this recent settlement, one of the problems we had early on in the discussions was they said, look, we're talking about tax years 82-84. And they say, well, you know, these same issues are involved in 85 and 86, and we're really not anxious to settle these issues in 82-84. If they're coming up again in 85-86, because how do we know that, you know, you won't turn around after you get 82 and 84 and, you know, hit us with a sledgehammer and not take a consistent position? So that seemed to have some merit, made a little sense. Then came along, well, you know, many of the same issues are involved in '86, '87, or '88, '89, or '93, whatever. A little confused about just the years, but in subsequent years, mm-hmm. Yeah, or earlier years, whatever. And so you say, well, you know, first thing, let's get the auditors together and get this. Put the auditors together in the same room. So then once we got our pretty much our complete case together, then we were able to sit down and talk about it. One of the things I think, and I have said this and I say it publicly, I think it's very important that when we conclude these negotiations that we're able to sit down and shake hands, and laugh, and talk, and say, well, we have some more things to do, and we'll see you by the by when we are able to start this process together. Because I think that it's very important for the state that a lot of the rancor, hard feeling, and ill will not arise out of this process. And I'm pleased to say I think we've been able to accomplish that. We found the taxpayers to be very professional and well prepared. And I think the process has been good, and it's been wholesome, and I think that the state has benefited by it. I just wanted to give you that overview to let you know how we go about this process. Sometimes, you know, we get it done. Sometimes we just have to go back and start all over. So there you be. I want to say that Mr. Baldwin can give you more detail, and if you wish, I'd be glad to answer any questions about that general subject you might wish to propound to me.
Well, thank you very much, Attorney Cole. If I might ask, you indicated that there was unanimity before you actually went to the taxpayer. When that taxpayer comes, as at least sometime in this negotiation with BP, for example, they come back and want to talk with you, then does the agreement that you finally reach, is that also a unanimity requirement in your department?
With what I call the negotiating team or the settlement team, the unanimity prevails throughout the entire process, right down to the final signatures on the line. Everybody must agree. You know, everyone has always agreed where we get there. You know, sometimes, you know, you almost have a sense of buyer's remorse, you know. It's done, you say,
Yeah.
But I'm sure that the feeling exists on the other side too. But everybody, you know, signs off verbally. Yeah. And we've had good teams. We haven't had any disputes. I think the Department of Law brings much to the process, and I think the Department of Revenue brings much to the process. And you know, we've really worked well together at all levels in my transport.
I've got another question, if I might, that perhaps Mr. Baldwin is going to cover, but just one of the things that goes through my mind, and I'm sure goes through other people's mind who may not be familiar with the workings of the oil industry and or the taxing authority, that we're talking about a significant number of dollars here, and that there could be an agreement when obviously the taxpayer had a view and the state had a view. To be that far apart, at least if it's not that far apart, it deals with enough things, enough barrels, enough operations that the settlement is a significant sum. How is it that you can reach a compromise on such a big issue when you obviously were quite a bit apart before you got to the table? Maybe that's not something you want to...
It's magic.
I see.
It's magic. Really, it is. You know, it's an art form. It's an art form. You know, it isn't something that you can just write it down in a book and say, this is the way you do it. It takes skills that, you know, one maybe hones when one starts collecting accounts for clients for $175 open accounts and say, you know, this guy hasn't paid, and go collect it, and be sure and get interest on the account too, you know. And by the way, get your attorney fees from him too, you know. And, you know, after you, I don't say that I have any particular skills at it, but after you've been doing that for 40 years, well, you sort of get a sense of, you know, what works and what doesn't. And, you know, we just work at it. And we talk, debate the issues. Here was the briefing book that we put together for this session in Seattle, which I say, I think I read every word in it, you know, and So we're well prepared, as are the other members of the team. A lot of work goes into these, and we're able to discuss these issues, you know, very constructively. And then we work a little magic.
For the interest of the people at the CIO, Attorney General Cole held up a three-ring binder that's about 3 inches thick. I have one or two other things, and then I'll certainly ask if anybody in the table or if the audience wants to ask a question. But attorney's fees are always a question in settlements, and would you mind telling us, or was the settlement, the fact that you went to outside counsel, did they hold out the fairly large settlement fee, or was this
I think in this settlement, the attorney fees were fairly negligible. I really don't know what they were, but they were not a large factor.
It wasn't like a 1/3% or something.
Oh, no. Terrible. I mean, I don't have a sense, but in some ways, really tempted to say de minimis. You know, there were some in this case, some, I'd say, exotic issues out there. First, you know, worldwide apportionment issue, which you know about. Then I don't want to say publicly what other issues were, but some very exotic issues. And we went to outside counsel to test our evaluation of those issues. I mean, obviously, we wind up with $630 million. There's a lot of money involved. And you want to make sure you're not off, in orbit someplace in the analysis. And what I think we largely got from outside counsel in this case was assurance from them that our analysis was correct, we were on the right track, and it gives you a sense of comfort in one's negotiations of how tough you can really be in negotiating these various issues. And that's why we wanted premier counsel to help us on that. But the attorney fees were really largely de minimis. We did this mostly in-house. Let me just check. Would you say that that's true?
Yes. I'm certain that we spent less than $300,000 outside counsel.
And there's no entitlement to attorney's fees in an administrative proceeding anyway.
Yeah, but I think less than $300,000 is an accurate figure here. Yeah. Just so you know, we're not going around.
That's excellent.
Plus the amortization of the $50 million.
We think we recovered that in the royalty cases. And as a matter of fact, the material we gleaned in that case, in the royalty cases, has not been particularly significant in this claim. It's more significant in the production tax issues where, how much was the value of the oil. So that's, we'll use that more over there. But no, I think $300,000 is probably an accurate figure. When we had an attorney fees, we retained some really top-flight people. One at UC Berkeley, and like I say, Mr. Hellerstein, and some other folks who gave us some guidance. And it helped, when you sit there and say, you want to know that you're comfortable with if you have to take it all the way.
I have just one other question, then I hope I'm not taking away from your presentation, Mr. Baldwin.
No, that's fine.
The question I have is, there is a possibility, I would think, in a settlement such as this, that you may be establishing a precedent in the final agreement that is made. Is there a possibility that that would happen? That obviously you would probably establish, obviously you would probably, anyway, establish a precedent in subsequent years. What about the possibility that, as you say, some of these exotic things, would that establish precedents in law?
No, okay. I think not. No, because they're all different.
Each
assessment is different. Yeah. And like I say, I Mr. Baldwin reminded me, I think that the sense that I have from speaking with these taxpayers that they're glad to address these things, want to address them. That's my sense. They may say it differently, but that's my sense. Let's see, there was one other thing. I guess that completes all I wish to say.
Do they want to ask Attorney General Cole any questions?
Representative Olberg, just one comment. I believe I read in the BP's press release that this wouldn't have a significant effect on their year-end results because they'd already accounted for it. So they must have been preparing for some sort of result like this.
Well, they said it wouldn't make a material difference in their tax statement, and but they didn't say how much they had reserved for it, so I let it go with that. Maybe that answers the question somewhat obliquely, but I guess that's probably all I'd better say.
Well, thank you very much for that overview.
I'm a little tired. I want to get some exercise so I can start again tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Good night.
Good night. Now we have Jim Baldwin.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, with your leave, could I ask the Deputy Attorney General, Bruce Patello, join us at the table?
Absolutely. Please do.
Bruce is my boss. He also served as the supervising attorney in my present position on oil and gas matters in Juneau, and generally is the person I turn to for supervision, direction, and also the institutional knowledge. I'll make this brief because the hour is late. I'll give you the general idea of how we handle oil and gas litigation and how we finance it, which I think is probably going to be a topic that's going to be weighing heavily on your minds as you move through the session and consider the budget. It's a significant item in the budget, and what I provided to you is some information that explains to you what it is we've asked for and what we've asked for in the past. It gives you some of our glory numbers, which is what we've obtained through successful litigation and the effect of that, and also a comparison of what we spent, what we've got. We're giving you all the good news here today. Some of the things I'm going to be telling you about next are the other kinds of litigation that we have. Attorney General Cole described to you the significance of the recent settlement that was now announced, and it's very happy coincidence that we're here discussing our operations right after a big settlement. We didn't quite time it that way, but it's worked out nicely. The situation there was an income and excise tax case that involved principally questions of law, and therefore was a case that could be handled in a very cost-effective manner. In other words, we did not have to develop facts and obtain the testimony of experts over a multitude of fields in order to properly present our case, all of which is very expensive. Now, there are other areas of litigation that are within our sections that are not that way at all. In fact, they're quite the opposite. We for this upcoming fiscal year, we're probably going to spend in the neighborhood of $25 million to finance the various areas of litigation that the state is involved in as a party. Of that $25 million, approximately 18 to 19 million of it will go to finance the cost of outside counsel and experts and various witnesses. So you can see it's a fairly expensive operation to maintain. The types of litigation that we are handling within our area is basically oil and gas tax, which is the severance tax or the production tax. In that area, we have approximately $1 billion in outstanding appeals covering various taxpayers. That's a rough number. It's hard to give you an exact number because we have cases in all levels of development. Someone called me today from the Senate staffer, and said, well, now that you've got BP out of the way, I guess we can cut how many attorneys were involved in that case now from your budget. And I explained to them that it's just like a pipeline. It rolls on down the hill towards us. It starts out at a certain level, an audit level, and moves through various administrative phases and comes to us eventually in the form of a case. And we get involved at various stages along that pipeline. But the pipeline extends off across the horizon. And as this case empties out, the next one just sort of lines right up after it. So we don't have much of a vacation after the settlement of this particular BP case.
Excuse me, Jim. You said $1 billion. Does that include what was just settled, or is that in addition to?
That's a rough number that would be in addition to what was just settled. Those are like pending appeals, the value of pending appeals that are out there. We also have a category of case known as income and excise cases, and that one is the category that covers the BP case. Okay, the number I just gave you was for oil and gas severance or production, different kind of tax. BP was a different, I don't have a number for that for you today because I have to go back and make some adjustments, but that is a significant number as well, in the hundreds of millions of dollars. We also have a category of case known as royalty cases.
You missed also separate accounting, which right. encompasses the years, tax years 78 through 81, which would again be in the billion plus range in dispute. So we have three categories of taxes we're really dealing with: the production or severance tax, the separate accounting income tax, and then the worldwide unitary or worldwide combination that goes by a number of names, the kind of tax, which was at issue in the BP settlement we reached yesterday.
Was it your intention to discuss or describe what separate accounting, how that varies, or was that the committee's? Is the committee interested in that as to why that would be an issue? Or?
I don't suppose it can be done in 25 words or less.
I'd be glad to work with and discuss this with any member of the committee individually. I think that if we tried to get into the intricacies of the tax, number one, I would be stumbling all over myself. And number two, it's a very complex subject matter.
But in 25 words, it attempts to put a fence around the state of Alaska and economic activity or income generated solely and separately accounted for activities of a corporation, oil and gas corporation, doing business in Alaska, as opposed to how that income might be assessed looking at a worldwide operation, which is really the contrasting worldwide combination. It was a constitutional challenge to the separate accounting income tax brought by the entire industry. It's one that was ultimately decided by the Alaska Supreme Court in 1984. It was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which denied cert in 1986. The legislature was quite concerned. Many constitutional scholars raised substantial questions about the constitutionality, the fear that that the state might in some way be forced to refund the billions that were being generated by separate accounting, led the legislature to enact, among other things, or adopt for the oil and gas industry the worldwide combination approach, which is what the state has relied on in addition to the severance tax for its impact. Actually, I note that Greg Erickson, a major player in that field, is also in the audience today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And let the record reflect that it did not take 25 words or less. but aptly described. The next category that we handle in the area is an area known as the royalty cases. Attorney General Cole explained to you that there was a major settlement on what we call the royalty and values part of the case, and he stated that that case is substantially decided. That's not quite correct. In fact, you're going to be seeing some budget requests for a major amount for the remaining part of that case. This is what's known as the Amaretta Hess case. Mm-hmm. It's been going since the 70s. It's been filed and proceeding since the 70s. Last year, or actually in November of 91, there was a major settlement announced, which by its terms provided a methodology for fixing the value of the royalty oil, the state's royalty oil, whether it's sold it's provided in value, basically, the value part of it. And we take money for our royalty oil, essentially. That case, as I said, that part of the case was settled. A total of $633 million is attached to that part of the settlement. That's for everything that's happened from 77 till 90, sometime in 92. And then the settlement has the effect of providing a methodology for setting the price of our royalty oil into the future. So it is a case of monumental significance as far as the state's revenue picture goes. What remains in that case left to litigate are basically three or four categories of issues. I'll go into the two major ones. One major issue is how much the state should pay producers for cleaning and conditioning of natural gas liquids that are produced as a part of the oil flow from the North Slope field. That case has a value to the state, considering past and possible future values, of about $500 million in total recovery, if we win on the best case scenario. Another aspect of the royalty case is what we call the royalty in kind disputes. And these concern the state's entitlement to a retroactive price adjustment on our existing royalty oil contracts, going back to the period from inception to present day performance on those contracts. These contracts carried clauses that tied the value of the oil to the outcome of the Amaretta Hess in value settlement. So we couldn't determine how much the royalty in kind producers or purchasers owed us until we had that part of the Amaretta Hess case settled and finally determined. The value of those settlements in total, of those claims in total, is approximately $300 million. We have concluded settlements with some of these purchasers, PetroStar being one, with a total of settlement of about $2 million. Tesoro, with a settlement that has a value of approximately $94 million. We've just concluded those recently, and they've been in the press. We are in litigation now with other purchasers, those being Chevron and MAPCO. And we are in multiple litigation with MAPCO, as a matter of fact, made more than one lawsuit in more than one judicial district of the state. That is a very expensive set of litigation, and I expect that we're going to be in the what size is the table aspect of litigation that we're going to sit around for a long time here. We're basically threshing out procedural aspects of that case. It's a fact-intensive case, and we'll be probably going on, unless, you know, short of a settlement, I suspect for perhaps two more years before there's any, we see any kind of resolution of that case. Have I covered everything, Ralphie?
Just to put it in a little more context, Jim alluded to the royalty in value or royalty in kind. The state, by contract, as the royalty and by statute, is entitled to 1/8 of everything that comes out of the ground, and the state had a choice to make. It exercised that choice several times. It could take it in value and basically allow the industry, the producers, to go ahead and market and sell. And that really was a major portion of what Amarada Hess case part one was about. What was the value of the oil? What should the state be able to get in its 1/8 portion? The state was also able to take it in kind. That is, they could actually take the state could take the oil itself, could do whatever it wanted with it, and it chose to sell it. Because of the litigation, again, there was an ambiguity about what price the state should get in return. And the contracts, a variety of them issued over the years, the state took approximately half of the oil at various times in kind as oil and resold. The solution to finding value was to tie it to the outcome, either by settlement or litigation in the Amarada Hess case. And the disputes involving the various royalty in kind purchasers revolve around either whether there was an implied or explicit ceiling on the amount of the additional liability beyond what they paid, or whether the fact that the state actually settled, whether the resolution accurately and adequately set an appropriate value, which the producer or the purchaser should be expected to pay. And it should be noted as well, we are going directly against both MATCO and Chevron, but we also are going as an assignee of claims that Tesoro had against Chevron as well. Tesoro bought oil from us, turned around and sold it to Chevron, again with that clause, and we have moved into Tesoro's shoes, basically, and that triggers a whole different round of litigation. In fact, last week, MATCO filed a suit against Tesoro in California Superior Court, challenging the right of Tesoro to make that kind of assignation to the state. And so we're finding ourselves in a position where we may be having to litigate this issue in California as well. A little more flavor on the royalty side.
Yes, again, to emphasize what's involved here, there's a total amount out there in claims, potential claims of $327 million. So far, we've resolved approximately $99 million worth of those claims. We received $47 million that was paid under protest, and that leaves a balance of about $181 million in total outstanding claims that we have asserted against our royalty in kind purchasers. We have a substantial stake here. We expect next year to spend approximately $6 million pursuing these claims. It's a very volatile area, as the Deputy Attorney General has explained to you. We have had multiple cases filed against us. We have filed multiple cases in return. We've been sued in a foreign jurisdiction. I don't see an inexpensive way out of this particular litigation. So we're bound to spend the money.
Did I understand you then to say that in some cases you will be suing a company and perhaps also be a partner in another lawsuit against a different company?
That's
correct. I can see where it begins to get very convoluted.
Yes.
Yes, well...
It is a lawyer's dream and perhaps the taxpayer's nightmare.
Yes, as part of the tutorial settlement, I can go into that for a little bit. We were dealing with a party who wanted to find a way to settle with us, but also to structure its debts in a way so that it could continue in profitable operation. And we worked very hard to do that in the way we structured our settlement. And one of the ways that we did that was to basically take over their rights to claim against another purchaser of the oil. Basically, they had bought the oil and resold it to someone else. And in order to take some of that burden off their shoulders, we took what in essence was an assignment of 40-some million dollars worth of that claim. Good person to have owing you money, let's put it that way. We felt that it was good to go after that company. They're also able to hire phalanxes of lawyers to throw at us, so we have some of the litigation we have to move our way through before we can resolve those claims. The next area that we are involved in is what we call our FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We find more and more that as a seller of oil, we have to be watchful of the pipeline tariffs that are set for the various pipelines, the carriers of our oil. And where we have to, the forum that we have to undertake that activity is, unfortunately, located in Washington, D.C., Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And we hire attorneys who are resident there, and we have attorneys in our office who interface with them. We carry on this representation. We have, and it's important for one very simple reason. The value of our oil is determined by netting out, among other things, the price of transporting that oil. So in order to get maximum dollar into the state treasury, we try to make certain that that tariff is figured as finely as possible so that it is not too much is netted back. And so we have had some cases that, one that was settled recently, the Endicott Pipeline, the way that settlement worked by a tariff was put in place some years ago. We protested it. It continued in place at the rate filed while the protest was going on. We ultimately settled with the carrier at a lower rate, and because of that, the state is entitled to a refund of tax and royalty. And the net effect of that Endicott Pipeline settlement is about $10.2 million to the state treasury, which we'll probably realize sometime next summer. But it will have a continuing effect through the year 2007, I believe, a total effect of some $14 million on the state treasury. So that's kind of what we do. We are basically watchdogs of the carriers and their filings. There are some other cases that we're watching, none of them with the rate significance of Endicott, nor of another major case that we were watching and we continue to monitor, which is known as the TAPS tariff settlement, something like that. Settlement, when it was entered into some years ago, was worth an initial payment to us of about $250 million in refunds. That has a tremendous effect going forward on our revenues of something. I have a handout among the materials that I provided to you. It's, and I can point it out to you when you get there, but I think it's somewhat in the neighborhood of $3 billion in increased revenues over the life of the tariff, the life of the pipeline. I can, sorry, I can't point it out immediately too, but I have some charts in here that will explain that to you. Yeah, it's the last page of exhibit. I believe it's exhibit
3.
Yeah, the last page says TAPS. We figure it's about $2.6 billion out into the future. Mm-hmm. That would be the effect of that settlement. We continue to monitor those filings, and through that monitoring activity, we recently reported to the legislature and the Office of Management and Budget, the upcoming effect of the new filing as far as being a total for the calendar year of approximately $80 million increase in revenues because of the change in the tariff structure. And we continue to do that monitoring year by year and make those reports so that the legislature has a clear picture of what the expected revenues will be for the upcoming fiscal year.
The last issue dealing with FERC is less a revenue issue than a safety one, and that is the issue of corrosion on the pipeline. And obviously it is in the state's interest to make sure that adequate funds are made for to ensure the integrity of the pipeline, and at the same time making sure that imprudent costs are not again imposed or included as part of the tariff rate base. It was in fact work of our lawyers and their experts at first determined the blip of the corrosion problem in 1989, and it's one that we continue to work with the TAPS owners and with Alyeska Pipeline Service Company to work cooperatively in making sure that we have a pipeline corrosion correction plan, as it were, that satisfies the safety requirements and also is done in the most cost-effective way. And that accounts for really the bulk of the money that we devote to the FERC activities right now.
Yes, we expect that in the upcoming fiscal year we're going to spend $1.5 to $2 million just on our FERC monitoring activities. And as Bruce indicated, a major part of that is the expense of hiring an expert who is doing a corrosion monitoring program, which is part of an alternate disputes resolution process that we're engaged in now with the carrier, the pipeline carrier. We expect that we'll be, the way things look, although it's kind of unsettled right now, it looks like we're going to be engaged in that program for another year, and it is a significant safety issue with the state and with other shippers on the pipeline. We have, so as I said, approximately $1.5 to $2 million next fiscal year will be engaged in this effort. We have other litigation that's assigned to this particular area, what we call oil and gas litigation. One involves our entitlement to the lands underlying the Beaufort Sea. That case has significant revenue implications for the state. However, the extent of potential revenue to be realized from that piece of litigation is unclear and uncertain, since we're engaged in litigation and have been for quite some time with a very well-financed and serious adversary in the form of the federal government. They have all the battleships and guns, so the outcome of that litigation is in doubt. But the stake is great. We have, there is an escrow fund sitting out there, which would be a potential source of recovery for us of over $1 billion. The status of that case is that we have been waiting a master's decision. We expect it to be delivered sometime in the late spring.
June.
Yes. And then everyone expects that no matter what the master decision reads, that we'll be in the U.S. Supreme Court. It's a master that was appointed by the U.S. Supreme Court, and we're already doing the groundwork for our briefing on that in that matter. It's not an, it's at this point we're figuring that this is going to cost us about $500,000 for the next fiscal year, which is, as you can see, these numbers seem less less oppressive as we go down the list here, but this is a very significant piece of litigation involving mostly, at this point, questions of law. And it's one that has been long awaited, but we're going to have to wait even longer for an outcome. It looks like the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, will not be prepared to render a decision for a year, perhaps. Bruce, I think you know more about the oil ban than I do. We have litigation pending in our, out of our Anchorage office dealing with the oil export ban. Mm-hmm. And I see the bills every once in a while. I'm not quite sure where we stand in that litigation, but we are still in the lower court and basically slugging it out in the trenches. I cannot give you any more detail on that case than that, other than that we have an attorney in-house who's devoted mostly to that case, plus we have outside counsel.
I was going to ask Senator Stevens today, unfortunately we ran out of time on questions. Will that be a litigation, or would there be something that if our three federal representatives were able to, could they get enacting legislation that would help?
Mr. Chairman, the congressional delegation has historically attempted to have the ban lifted. There was some hope that if the in the waning days of the Bush administration, that an executive order might be issued that would arguably give some authorization for export of crude oil itself. Did not happen. Our efforts in the Department of Law are aimed solely at challenging the underlying authority of the executive branch of the federal government to impose the ban. And we're actually proceeding on two different fronts. We have one claim in front of the U.S. Court of Claims in Washington, D.C. To be very candid, we do not think we have a very good chance of pursuing it there. We have a separate case filed in U.S. District Court. We're dealing primarily with prospective relief, and again challenging the underlying authority of the executive branch to impose the ban. But our efforts are exclusively litigation in nature, as opposed to looking at legislative effects.
Okay, what I want to do now, I think we've touched the major areas that we are, all the areas that we.
We might want to do a time check with the committee, Mr. Chairman. Again, this might be the appropriate time to either break at your desire, or we could also proceed with additional material.
What sort of time frame, you finish, how much more time would it be? It may be that we've, what was it Stephen said, that your brain is only able to absorb what your rear end can endure?
Yeah.
Or something?
The only thing I was going to do, and I was going to make it very merciful, was just kind of flip through what we're given, just kind of give you a description of what it is. I think you probably want to hand it, you want to look at it yourself, I'm sure, read it carefully, and then next thing you'll do is hand it to your staff and have them give me a call if they have any questions. And you can call too, and I'd be glad to meet with you. What we've got here basically is on the first exhibit behind my cover memo is an explanation of our budget over the past three fiscal years. Just so you can understand what it is you've asked for in money. Then I have a brief chart of the disputes that I've just discussed and the major settlements that we've entered into, just kind of an easy chart that you might find useful in for your purposes. The next one is a list of oil and gas settlements since 1982 that we've together with a total in the various areas I've just discussed. The next exhibit is a list of every appropriation we've ever received for oil and gas litigation. So if you want to go back and see what it is we've gotten, what it is we've spent, it's all right there. You don't have to research it on your own. It totals $180 million. And then the final chart, which I hold up to the committee for its visual effect, is the comparison between what we've recovered and what we've spent. The tall one being what we recovered, and the little tiny one, which is yet $180 million, is what we spent. So that's all it is.
That certainly is an impressive assemblage there. And yes, I think it would be very helpful if we had a chance to maybe go through, digest this, and then contact your office, unless we've got a very perceptive committee here, unless there are some questions that
I'd just like to say that we stand ready to serve as a resource to this committee as it considers legislation during the session. We'd like to be considered a resource to the chairman and any member of the committee.
I think that's excellent, because I think that will happen. Several of us are new to the oil industry. We're new to the process in general, and so I think we would be well advised to come to you with our questions. Do any of the members have any questions, or are there questions from any of the people in the audience?
Mr. Chairman, just to reiterate Jim's offer to you in terms of our assistance, we also have in the past, from time to time, brought in outside counsel to give briefings on very specific cases, such as Almirante Hess, or an overview of our various Federal Energy Regulatory Commission proceedings. And to the extent that the committee might want a more detailed briefing, with some advance notice, we can arrange to have outside counsel report directly to you and be available for your questions and concerns.
I think that would be excellent, because I'm sure that there are some people who are, when you say the Amarada Hess case, they know it's a company, but they really don't know much about it. So it might be in the future, as we're trying to get our feet on the ground, that would really be helpful. And for the interest of anybody at the LIO, if they have a desire for the handouts, we can make those available. It's very impressive if you, if you'd like to go through it. It's quite a thing, so we could make copies available for anybody who would contact my office. I was just handing a note. I'm not quite sure what it means.
Those are the people that are observing.
Okay.
Just so you're aware who's on.
Okay. Thank you. We have a representative from Exxon who's at the LIO, and one of my staffers, Jeff Logan. So if the Exxon representative, Mr. Ryder, would care for any of this information, we'd certainly make it available to him. Do you know him?
Mr. Ryder, if you could give me a call tomorrow, we have another matter we need to discuss.
Are there any other questions from the committee? If not, I certainly want to thank you, gentlemen, for coming in, and I appreciate your offer to come back and give us some more detail. I would certainly appreciate that. And we're standing adjourned.